Hello.
Hello. Hello, Jonathan.
You're here.
I'm here. How are you?
I'm good. So I'd like to start off this interview by asking you, what was your first experience with Lean or Scrum or these methods that you're so interested in?
Wow. My first exposure to Lean or Scrum. So it goes back a long ways. I would say it starts in 1995 when I joined Dow Chemical. I remember the book was called Kaizen, and it was subtitled Flight of the Buffalo. And it was about the transformation that Japanese culture had made in manufacturing by building self-empowered work teams who all solved quality issues together. And so I was inspired at a young age. I think I was 22.
And do you think that's when, like, as soon as you're exposed to the idea, sort of all the passion came to you then? Or was it gradual? Would you say that your level of excitement about it now matches what it was as soon as you're introduced to it? Or did it grow?
Well, I think what I call it and what it is to me and how I can use it to help unlock the potential of others has certainly grown. I happen to be a passionate guy, so I was passionate about it then. I dove in and learned about total quality management and Six Sigma and how you could use statistical analysis to reduce variability. But I never saw it as a people leadership model until more recently, really the last 4 years, where I've seen it as the solution to helping unlock others for their potential.
And would you say it's Scrum that's done that? As opposed to two-second lean, or is it both?
Yeah, no, two-second lean is a simplified approach to get to grow a culture of continuous improvement. I would say that that was a model that came just at the right time when we were looking for a way to engage all of our workforce at Cambridge to do so.
Okay.
Scrum was later. Scrum is basically how do you take projects and project teams and build high-functioning teams that can accomplish projects. So they're really, I would say, different in their methodologies, but similar in their desire for unlocking, you know, the best out of people.
Mm-hmm.
One is for managing people, managing teams, and one is for building a culture where everybody's unlocked all the time on continuous improvement.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there was just an average person listening who didn't understand these ideas or didn't understand the process or didn't understand how it applies, who only heard this thing described with the weird word methodology, that does not seem like something a person is even capable of being passionate about, you know, some kind of methodology that applies to an engineering company, right? So how would you dispel the sort of the mystery of how some sort of methodology or some way of being productive can make a human being passionate?
Well, I think that deep inside, all of us want to be everything we were created to be. I think that everybody wants to make a huge impact in this world. And most of us find that the world fights back and stops us from doing so. And so we start to get frustrated and we start to get overwhelmed by what's going to be required to make an impact in the world. And so I think that what two-second lean does for me is it shows me how to break free of that, to not be held down by the chains that are around us in the systems that we work in. And it allows me as an individual to become the best version of myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I do that with basically decreasing the barriers of making small improvements to make it so that every day I look for small ways to improve my own life and make those physical improvements tangible and sustainable, I grow in confidence and capability to make larger and larger improvements in larger and larger systems.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's worth getting passionate about. when you can do that individually, and then when you can create systems where other people can do that, that's worth getting passionate about.
And this is just something I'll add because I think it's an interesting thing for the listeners. And also you compound it if you've got anything to say after that. But me, I'm for anyone who doesn't know, I'm a pretty young. I'm 20 years old. I'm in college. I haven't worked within any companies really. You know, that hasn't been my day in, day out thing, but I'm getting more experience with it lately. And it's something that you realize can be kind of depressing, kind of, belittling isn't the right word, but it can make you feel like what you're doing is insignificant, like you're doing something, like you're simplifying yourself to make yourself useful in some kind of way. And this is, not to get too broad with it, but I think it's interesting because it actually does apply here, is this is the thing that supplied Marxism with a bunch of people who were thought it was the answer to all the world's problems, because they were realizing that in order to make the world function, you know, in order to contribute to the industries that made human life better, they were engaging in increasingly mundane tasks for an increasing amount of their day. So the world at large was something that was getting a lot more efficient and a lot more comfortable, or at least it had a greater capacity for comfort. There were more tools, there were more products available, even though they weren't available to all classes. But the point is that even though as far as the things we were able to produce were making life more comfortable, the life that we needed to live to produce those things was getting less comfortable or less meaningful. And that's one of the reasons a lot of people thought that capitalism, that's one of the things that Marx gives is in his sort of criticism of capitalism, is the total disconnection between the worker and what they're producing. And it seemed like a kind of, not just a slavery of your time, but a slavery of your being. And this is something that you and I talked about the first time we ever spoke together, was the fact that that problem, the problem of having your everyday life, even though you have to engage in things that you're not necessarily interested in, how to make your daily life sort of meaningful. And the fact that that was a problem that a lot of people had tried to solve in a lot of different ways. And it was probably one of the problems that the world exerted the most energy into trying to solve, because we know how huge then passionate the revolutionaries, people who wanted to bring about communism, was. Regardless of the results, they thought it was the absolute new world. They thought it was the beginning of everything when it was happening, you know, before it had its outcomes. They thought it was like ushering in a new era. So the fact is that people do actually care incredibly about this. It's just that solutions to it take different forms. And that's what got me interested in Scrum, is our connection of Scrum to the to this problem of meaning in your everyday life.
Yeah. So I think what I hear you saying is the large problem, which is meaning in life, and providing work that is meaningful for people to accomplish in their life, mm-hmm. is a large challenge. Mm-hmm. One, you know, I think the Gallup polls say that 80% of the people in work today in the U.S., which is a capitalistic society where we want people to thrive, and 80% are saying that they're disengaged at work, that they don't care about their jobs. Mm-hmm. And so how do you describe, I mean, that's such a painful statistic,
yeah.
to watch and hear, yeah. that 80% of people are spending 40 plus hours a week in meaningless, dehumanizing work. What a sad reality. And so what I hear you saying is that any solution to that would be massive, mm. and has the potential for significant, beautiful global change. Mm-hmm. And the reality is obviously you mentioned one that has failed to bring that kind of change, which is communism. But the reason that it was powerful was it was trying to solve that. That's what I'm hearing you say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. So what if we could find a way under a capitalistic environment? What if you could find a way where there was a free market that was driving the majority of the economy, mm-hmm. and still could provide meaningful work to the majority of people?
Okay.
That where everyone could be producing and enjoying and thriving and growing. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, one of the things we're working on together is the school environment, which is, you know, a kind of a mini business environment where you're quote paid grades by your effort in class. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you went to the statistics, you know, what percentage of students do you think are disengaged in their work at school?
definitely the majority. I would say probably the same amount as people who are disengaged at work.
And why is that?
Well, because it's something that they have to do, and they haven't connected what they want to do with what they have to do, and they haven't found a way of connecting what they want to do with what they have to do. The practical side of life and the romantic and personal side of life. It's hard to make those ends meet.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the a great quote that I have lived by inside of Cambridge is what is mandatory becomes optional, and what is optional becomes mandatory.
Mm.
And so what's meant by that is that I believe there's too much mandatory requirements in the classroom that are dictated to students, and not enough optional activities that are mm-hmm. creative and ready to be absorbed and consumed by the students.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have things that are mandatory, they become optional, meaning that people say, well, screw it, I'm not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to disengage. Whether I actually do the activity or not, my heart's not going to be in it.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you think about inspiring environments where people are thriving and growing, it's mostly optional activities that are driving people, and they self-motivate and self-organize, and they create on their own because it's something they want to do. And so I think we've got to move closer to that in the classrooms, is making more optional that drives what it means by it drives mandatory. The culture creates a requirement on the people because the culture is so attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes mandatory just because it's like, if I want to be here, I got to do this thing. Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want to be part of the group.
Yeah. And that's what got me. That's probably what, that's the moment I realized how this applied to education was the moment I was actually excited about it, because I'm somebody who is passionate about learning, and school was definitely much more a barrier to learning for me when I was growing up than it was something that fostered learning, because the things I was learning about were things that were unrelated, abstract. It was memorization. It was things that you had to know, but it wasn't something that I had a space in my mind waiting for that information. You know, in order to have an answer, you have to have a question first. So if I had plenty of questions of my own, and I would love finding the answers to them. But when I would go to school, I would find that answers were supplied without questions preceding them within the students. And that's what I thought was so beautiful about that model, was it basically puts the onus on the students to take an opportunity to educate themselves, or to take something and then find an answer to it. And that's the kind of learning, not only that you retain, but that excites you, that provides you meaning, that engages you, that you focus on, that you get to some flow with. That's something that really could supply a life with meaning and excitement. And the fact that the education system was regularly missing out on that was sad to me. And that's what excited me about Scrum.
Yeah. So if we take Scrum as a topic, I mean, if we go back a step, I mean, we're basically thinking about creating a makerspace, an environment where learners can drive the learning inside of the public school system. And if you think about that and the power of what could we do if students became engaged, passionately engaged in creating a new educational system, but did it on the small scale, on an experimental scale,
mm-hmm.
on a pilot scale inside of one classroom. I think there's been some good pilots run where schools, you know, Montessori schools or experiential schools, where private schools have set a stake and said, we're going to do education a completely different way.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, they're extremely expensive and mm-hmm. very selective. And so not very many people have access to them.
Mm-hmm.
They put out incredible results, students that are thriving,
mm-hmm.
but they're not accessible to 98% of the people in the U.S.
Yeah.
Public schools are this place where if we could prove out an experiential model where a classroom could actually be learner driven, and where people could actually build and students could be engaged at such a high level that they were driving forward the learning and becoming passionate about learning, and they were taking that back into their classrooms and infecting the rest of the groups with that kind of growth mindset,
mm-hmm.
that is exciting.
Yes.
And so we're really talking about, how do we create that in a makerspace? How do we create an environment where students are driving the learning in a makerspace? And that's the project we've been working on.
So now I've got a kind of difficult question, or it's a difficult question to kind of, you know, divide up and answer. But we've talked about the side of this that solves a problem of meaning, and we've talked just barely about the fact that what we're talking about is a methodology, is just a way of problem solving, a way of going about a task, a way of deciding what task to do. So connect for me, if you can, the way that this solves meaning, or the way that this provides meaning, with the methodology. So like going through the methodology or the simple process of it, how does that, how is it something that brings about more meaningful work as opposed to other things?
Okay. So I think, you know, first of all, you have to kind of start with the end in mind. So we're looking for learner-driven learning, where people own their own process. The students own their own process of how they learn and the continuous improvement of that learning. So that's our end goal. Now, the question is if you can provide enough structure to provide structured, safe environments for them to do that, so that they have enough freedom to create, but enough structure that it's not completely chaos. And so what you do is you've got to create rhythms or disciplines. You've got to create daily rhythms that allow for the students to feel comfortable that whenever they walk in at whatever level they are at currently in their learning path, you know, maybe some of them have been stuck for a long time and have a bad view of learning. Many of them might feel like they're ready for the next level, and some of them might be already driving much of their learning processes. And so what you want the structure to do is to provide safety and security for those three learner types anywhere along the path that they're at to be able to come in, enter the system, and grow in their ability to own their own learning plan. And so that's the process, you know, whenever you think about methodology, it's how do you create enough of a methodology or system that allows for that safety and security to experiment. So that's I don't know if that's at the high level. We can talk about the details, any of them that you'd like.
No, yeah, I think that's probably a pretty good overview of it, because I think that's something that when you talk about something that at least proposes a solution to a pretty large meaning problem that you find today in workforce and in society, I think increasingly, that's something people get excited about, but it's just something, it's something that you have to engage with regularly or enough to really understand the process to understand what it is that's solving this meaning problem. You know, so I'm saying that before someone's able to get excited about this thing specifically, then they have to understand the connection between what makes them excited about it and what it is that's solving or that it's providing that thing that they're excited about. You know, so that's, I think, the key barrier for people who don't know anything about this. The barrier between themselves and getting excited about the method is understanding that the method brings about these results, which everyone would love. You know,
yeah, I think I what I hear you saying is, yeah, you have to start with why. And if you don't start with why, nobody gets passionate about it.
Yeah.
The why has to be big enough that people can actually work through the barriers necessary to get through the challenges of actually creating it. And the why for me is so huge. If we could, you know, small shift that could actually make a change in how education is handled and where students were thriving and they were engaged. If think about that, if you went from, you know, if 80% of the students are disengaged now, if you could just flop that to 80% engaged, how cool would that be?
Yeah.
Where, you know, the thousands and millions of lives that would impact for not only this generation, but generations to come, because people would fall in love with learning. It's huge. It's got huge, huge potential. And so that's what our goal is. And if we say we won't stop until we've created a culture inside the classroom where people are learners are driving their own learning and thriving in that environment, then we can't fail. We just keep on trying and experimenting and trying and experimenting, shifting the daily habits, shifting the weekly rhythms until we get there. Start with the end in mind, start with why, and you can't be stopped because you just keep on trying and experimenting.
Yeah. Because that's what drives a person to begin with.
Exactly. That's what brings the passion. That's what gets people up early. That's what keeps them up late at night thinking about it. That's what's going to drive, you know, parents in to help support. It's what's going to drive students in. It's going to drive administrators in and resources, donors, people out in the community that want to see this succeed. They're going to drive in because of the why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, yeah. And I think that there's in a larger way, I think that the meaning problem that you could say we have in maybe Western civilization today, which at least I definitely see happening among my generation, is the fact that what you're doing is becoming more and more distant from why you're doing it. And the further away those things get from each other, and the more you realize that the things you're doing on a daily basis are simply not things you care about, then you understand. Then you could meet this moment where you realize that you've been doing things your entire life that you realize or you think are just not related to yourself at all, or have no larger purpose, have no meaning that you can connect it to, or anything like that. And I think that's what makes people maybe increasingly more depressed. That's why you get some of the depressing statistics that you have of today, is the fact that there is a disconnect between what people are doing and why it is being done in the first place.
And their own personal why. And
exactly.
Their own purpose.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I think I mentioned this to you. I think the, you know, all the bad press that the millennials generation have gotten due to their desire for purpose and work. You know, there's been a lot of stories about, you know, why do millennials need so much purpose? Why don't they just go to work and like the rest of us and just grind it out? Mm-hmm. And I think they have it right. I think they're supposed to be closer attached. I love how you said that. The how that you do, the what that you do in your daily life, in work and production and producing value for the community and for the world as a whole, should be very closely tied to your personal why. The closer, mm-hmm. the better, and the more passionate you'll be for doing what you do. Mm-hmm. And so if we could shift the conversation from millennials are the problem to millennials are the solution, and the why closely tied to what you produce and what you do in school, what you do at work, is the solution. We've got to get that closer tied so that everybody knows the why and everybody, mm-hmm. has that behind them.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it could be like a remedy to a much deeper problem, because yeah
I like it. So one of the things that we've not touched on is the you know, the class structure and what ends up happening. I think we should do it in another episode. What do you think?
I agree. I think that this is a good introductory episode, and then we can get into the minutia, the details, and connect the complex organism that is the Scrum method to the ultimate problem it solves for people.
Sounds good. We'll sign off and get back on in another call.
All right.
Take care, Jonathan.
You too.